With James Trexler at NRL on 18th of March 1974. Now, can you give me some idea of the early development of radar as you see it, and then how and why you got involved in it?
You mean radar astronomy.
Right, radar astronomy, right.
Well, my first connection with this was, I believe, in about 36. 1936, I think about that time, Allen of the FCC, chief engineer for the FCC, had some papers in the popular radio journals about the reflection of radio signals from meteors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly easy to look into this because at that time they were experimenting with VHF FM stations. I believe the stations were in what is now approximately channel one.
I see.
Of what is now television. It was just below the television band, and there was quite a bit of interest generated by Armstrong and others in FM communications, and the sudden bursts of signals that were received from very distant FM stations were first attributed to meteors,
mm-hmm.
Meteor trail reflections, I believe, by
right.
Allen. And this looked like an interesting project to get into as a college engineering physics kind of thing. And in connection with the engineering and the physics department at Southern Methodist University, I was given help from, I believe it was called the NYA. Was it called NYA? It was a government help for students kind of thing.
In the Depression.
I was given a couple of students to help in building antenna arrays, and we built several arrays, directional arrays, to determine the direction of arrival of these signals, which we thought were reflected from meteors, and eventually built under the direction of Dr. Lutz, who was our professor, Dr. S.G. Lutz, we built some instantaneous DFs using ADCOP antennas. And
is that direction finding?
Yes, direction finding. It's a system of direction finding which displays the instantaneous arrival angle of the signal on a cathode ray tube. And this was relatively new technology at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we used a new and very exciting cathode ray tube that was built by RCA that was 1 inch in diameter and could be built right into a movie camera very handily. And we were able to show that indeed the signals did seem to arrive from the meteor trails. And it was a undergraduate engineering project at Southern Methodist University.
Was this published at all?
There were no publications in regular journals. There's a very abbreviated publication in a school paper, a school journal. But this led to, this work led directly to my being hired here at the Naval Research Laboratory during 1942. And I went into the direction finding business here at the laboratory, which was then completely oriented towards detection of German submarines.
Right.
And it wasn't until the end of World War II that we went back again, starting looking at the reflection of meteors as a way of communicating, burst communication between remote points, distant points, using reflection from meteors. And
what would be the idea? You'd be continuously transmitting a signal and only once in a while would it get through?
That's right.
When you happen to have a meteor?
There were various techniques devised. One was to have the receiving station listen, and when he heard a signal from the transmitting station, to return the signal, and that would tell the transmitter to start sending traffic.
See.
And send traffic until the traffic would fail at the other end. Various systems were devised. Some of them could unload at a rate of equivalent of 60 words per minute by sending at very high speeds during the bursts themselves. Of course, it depends on the number of meteors per hour and sometimes the day the meteor count sometimes. A day and year, the meteor count goes way down, and your backlog of traffic builds way up, and then sometimes the meteor shower comes along, and you can unload the basket.
Has this ever been used?
Oh, yes. There were several military systems devised, and both by this country and other countries, to use this technique, and it's actually been used on for mobile platforms such as ships.
But what's the advantage over just using the ionosphere?
Well, it uses higher frequencies, which
where you don't have
the ionosphere, you can pass traffic pretty fast. It was just another method of communication, and it has these kinds of things led to tropospheric and ionospheric scatter communication, which are getting us farther and farther away from radar astronomy. Right. The early radar astronomy business that I remember was all associated after the meteor business, all associated with trying to get echoes from the moon.
Let me just ask, were there any publications from this meteor research, the scientific aspects of it as opposed to
Well, there's been a very large amount of it published in the standard journals.
I see, in the early 50s and so? Late 40s?
I think that it would be in that time frame, maybe into the 60s. The early aspects of it, because it was sponsored by the military, was probably classified. And gradually, it became a rather well-known technique, but not a very happy one because it was intermittent.
Okay, I'll just have to check on that. I'm not very familiar with that. But anyway, you were saying this got you...
Well, this business of getting off and trying to get echoes from the moon was a challenge from the very, very earliest radar experiments to get echoes from the moon. And Mr. Young here at the laboratory, who has been named as the co-investigator with Dr. Page and others for the early days of radar, was always on the lookout for long distance echoes. And he was very early, back in the 20s, I believe, identified around the world signals that he called echoes, but echo may be the wrong word here. And they've got signals which had made several complete circles of the globe. But they were always looking for a moon echo in this long delay. And without success, even though they sometimes thought they had enough radiated power and enough sensitivity, they never quite made it. And as we know, other investigators in other countries worked on this, and then we had the U.S. Army coming out with the first public announcement of it, and I believe that was 46.
Right.
This was announced very dramatically at the IRE, then now IEEE convention in New York. And almost immediately after that, other workers in the field started surfacing their results.
But no one did do it during the war, though.
I don't know. There have been reports. Many radar operators have told me that they had strong suspicion of receiving moon echoes on large military radars during the war, but it was suppressed. Information was suppressed, because there wasn't very much information generally published about radars, and if you had a radar good enough to see the moon, you certainly didn't want to talk very much about it. But I don't have any real firm evidence of this. I've also heard that one of the large radars installed German radars, the German radar...
Würzburg dishes?
Würzburg radar, installed at the Chesapeake Bay Annex of Naval Research Laboratory, contacted the moon very early, but I don't have any first-hand information of this and don't know of any publications. But you might check in with the radar. Maybe you ought to start with who's the associate superintendent of the radar division? Well, hit that level of people over there and see if they have any recollection of these early experiments.
Okay. Well, what about your connection with?
Well, our connection was quite backwards. We were interested here in the countermeasures branch of NRL in determining if reflection of signals from the moon would be useful as a method of intercepting signals. And to study this in detail, we wanted to produce our own signals and change their parameters and measure them. So that was the driving force, and in the early 50s, we obtained some money to build a quite flexible radar for doing this, one we could change the frequency of, and one that we could change the signal characteristics, and one which would have enough effective radiated power and enough sensitivity to get continuous results and not just sporadic results.
Right.
And so that's what led to the experimental work at Stump Neck.
Now you're talking about this hole-in-the-ground antenna,
which
is described in the 58 proceedings of the IRE.
That's right. And that that installation has operated, my memory is correct, from frequencies as low as maybe 30 megahertz up to as high as 400 megahertz.
Well, it says 198 to 3,000. Here.
Well, those were the successful operations at the time of the publication. 3,000 was not done on that dish. They were done it on the,
oh, I see,
on the 50-foot dish that's on Building 43. But we have carried out, with that dish in Southern Maryland, we carried out experiments down into the HF part of the spectrum. And since then, it's been carried on by the large antennas of CBD down even lower, probably at least as low as 16 megahertz, 12 to 16 megahertz, and went on up then into the several hundreds of megahertz, rather almost without gap, almost continuously through the spectrum. And we think that we, or thought at least at one time, that we knew the path loss to a fraction of a decibel. Had it tied down pretty well. One of the biggest confusing factors in that early work was the fact that we had something we called modulation loss, which was due to the fact that a short pulse signal hitting the moon would not illuminate all of the possible reflecting surface at the same time. And so as the signal washed across the moon, you picked up later signals. But if the signal were longer, were not such a short pulse, then there would be some...
You were illuminating the whole thing simultaneously.
Then there would be a gradual accumulation of echo until you got to a continuous wave kind of situation, which was many decibels stronger than you would have gotten with a very short signal. This led to the problem that for very short signals, like ones of 1 microsecond length, that it took a very high-powered radar to contact the moon, but this has been accomplished now and worked by places like Stanford and Arecibo. Observatory have been able to muster enough radar performance so that they can look 70, 80 dB down into the noise and down below the peak signal, peak echo, and see the limb of the moon, even see the edge, as well as the highlight at the center. I think the most interesting thing that we discovered immediately here at the laboratory when we made solid contact with the moon was that there was a highlight, an RF highlight at the center.
That's what the point of this paper is made, the specular
reflection.
That's right,
there's a quasi-specular point at the middle of the moon, and this would happen for almost any body, rough planetary body like this, and does enhance the echo, and enhances the utility of the object as a relay for communications or as a probe for studying interstellar space. You have a smaller point there to work with.
Right.
And it's been quite helpful in that respect.
As you were doing this work, were there other groups doing similar work that you knew about anyway?
Well, of course, running simultaneously in parallel with us was the work going on at Jardel Bank. And we had kind of a unofficial agreement between them that if one of us published, the other one would at the same time. And, and so this went on for quite a few years until finally at the IRSI meeting in Boulder, Colorado, and in a year, I don't know which, but it was just prior to the publication of this paper. Jarrell Bank people decided to publish their results of their moon probe radar work, and we presented a paper, that is, Naval Research Laboratory presented a paper on the Stump Neck, Maryland work at the same session of the IRSI, IRSI meetings. And this was followed by, well, I guess it was preceded by a paper by Collins Radio, and the National Bureau of Standards did a joint piece of work where one of the forward scatter radio propagation devices being developed by Collins Radio was used to transmit from central United States back here to Washington to the National Bureau of Standards Station near Washington at a fortuitous moment when the moon happened to pass through the beam of this very large antenna.
And is that published somewhere now in the IRSI proceedings? Or?
That was available in popular literature, popular magazines. I don't recall it being in one of the scientific journals, although it may well be. I believe the work was done at, my memory is it was done at 400 megahertz. There was simultaneously, there were attempts made by the Australians to transmit signals over the moon, communication type signals. Although this was tried quite a few times, I don't believe that it was successful until later in the 50s.
Now, you were, I assume that you were indeed sending all sorts of signals. It wasn't just a matter of detecting the moon, but you were able to communicate with yourself quite well and so forth.
That's right. Well, as far as communication goes, we showed that the moon circuit was better than had been anticipated by the early probe work by the Army at Red Bank. And I guess it is Red Bank, Bank Station. And their system was so marginal, and I'm not decrying the Army work. It was first and it was very good. But the signal level was so low that they couldn't really tell very much about what it was made up of and how it was made up. And we found that in fact we were several orders of magnitude higher quality or wider bandwidth transmission was possible, and that by putting a little bit of FM modulation on the signal to broaden its spectrum beyond the spectrum required for the communication rate, it is to make the signal artificially broadband. And I don't want to infer anything like what we call today spread spectrum, but in reality a little bit of spread spectrum, we were able to reduce selective fading and so that you wouldn't get into these deep null problems where the signal would disappear for a while and then come back. Also, it was soon discovered, not by the laboratory, but by other workers, it's referred to in the paper, it was discovered that there was a very pronounced polarization rotation effect. And as soon as that was realized, Faraday rotation was realized as the cause of this. Now you understand that Faraday rotation was a very well-known phenomenon. We just didn't tumble to the fact it was so important in this problem. as soon as that was realized, then almost everybody using the circuit went to circular polarization and got clear of that particular type of fading. We didn't pay much attention to it at first because we were working at such low frequencies that it was a fast form of fading. But as it went up in frequency, up into the UHF, it became a slow and very, at 400 megahertz, for example, it became a slow and very embarrassing type of fading. You'd lose the signal for long periods of time.
Well, how long did this work go on with the moon? Did it go on much after this article was published?
Well, there's been almost continuous work of some sort or other. The moon circuit was first developed for point-to-point military communications, and the first points were tied together were Hawaii and Washington in a Navy communication circuit, and that was extended to other kinds of military communication. And we think of it as the first satellite communication,
and
predated the artificial satellite communication by quite a bit. although it was never used at this rate, it was experimentally demonstrated that you could work 16 channel, 100 word per minute per channel, 100 words per minute on 16 channels simultaneously on one carrier.
Is the advantage once again that mainly higher frequencies can be used than in the ionosphere? More reliability about the
reflector.
That's
right, and it paid off. It paid off initially as a method of getting through when you had an ionospheric blackout.
Right.
And it did handle a lot of emergency traffic into Hawaii from the United States for a few of those ionospheric blackout conditions, but it was almost immediately overtaken by a submarine cable that went into Hawaii.
But what about the problem of the moon being there? I mean, it's only there.
Well, the moon is, of course, has to be available at both terminals, and if the two terminals are very far apart, then the amount of time goes down. Between Washington and Hawaii, it averages about 6 hours per day, and you have no control over what 6 hours those are.
They're right.
at the discretion.
So that was
of
perhaps one of the main drawbacks.
So it uses deferred or backup communication. Early days in the Navy. Use of it. It was used to handle a lot of routine administrative traffic, and it could unload a vast amount of it. It was never used to capacity because the capacity was greater than it was even thought necessary at those times. Now today, by today's standard of very broadband, high-speed communication, it wouldn't have held up. Well, it served in that kind of capacity for quite a while, and it's interesting to note that about the time it started to die down as a military communication medium or system, it started to pick up as an amateur radio communication, and it's quite actively engaged in now by radio amateurs as a way of communication.
Yeah.
Quite a few of them all over the world, South Africa, Australia, Europe, United States, communicate on a regular basis via the moon and with completely homemade antennas and homemade charts on where to look and how to do it. And one of the most interesting features that's appeared in the last few months has been that with this very continuous and intensive observation of the circuit, that on a few occasions reflections from something other than the moon have been seen, probably shock wave fronts from the
Few second delays.
Beyond the moon, in some cases.
Oh, beyond the moon, I see.
And these have been associated, I understand, with outbursts on the sun.
Yeah.
Things like this, where there's enough of a wave front coming in to give a reflection.
High enough density. Yeah.
I'm not sure that this is well understood yet, but at least some echoes of very long delay of this type have been seen.
Reminiscent of the meteor trails again.
That's right, only in this case much farther out. Yeah. So there is interesting activity in that way. I would say that right now, though, that the use of the moon as a communication, serious communication medium is almost gone to zero.
Did you do any more scientific investigation of the properties of the moon, per se?
No, that was under simultaneous investigation by Ben Yaffe.
Yes, I talked to him, right.
And Nancy Roman.
So you left that mainly to them.
And they carried that to a considerable extent. And then later, with the better equipment at Arecibo, they were able to actually get into mapping. And this, of course, has been carried out even to the more distant planets with quite high resolution and remarkable results. We in this group have never participated in that aspect of it. Although we have over the years tried to understand more about the statistical parameters of the echo from the moon and for what good it is in terms of a dispersive circuit, but more from an engineering propagation kind of than from an astronomy point of view.
Would you be willing to make a few comments on the reasons that Sugar Grove never worked out? I mean, without getting into the mechanical reasons, I mean, where did it go wrong and so forth? You were involved in that also.
Well, that's a very difficult one for me to talk about for two reasons. One, I was awfully close to it. The other reason is that there's still a lot of aspects of it that are not declassified. The problem there was that we were trying to build an antenna which was beyond the state of the art at the time, and we took the risk of trying to start the job before the design was finished. This was considered at the time to be a reasonable risk.
It was a calculated risk.
A calculated risk. It was a known risk. There had been a lot of money spent on the design, probably more money spent on the design than almost anything that, up to that time. It's interesting to note that the company, which was the chief design company for the big antenna at Sherwood Grove, was simultaneously working on the Narrows Bridge in New York. And the staff on the Sugar Grove 600-foot antenna was more than 10 times the size of the staff on the Narrows Bridge, which was the biggest suspension bridge.